Welcome to Whiskey Cask, Cask Strength Conversation, featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 404 for December 28th, 2012. Coming up in a few minutes.
In order to be successful, you need to look at this as a business plan.
This week on Whiskey Cask In Depth, we'll look at entrepreneurs who have found a new way to raise funding for their whiskey-related projects. Blogger Rob Gart used Kickstarter to raise the money to publish his book about living on Isla and working at Brooklatty. His project is just one of several successful Kickstarter projects that we'll hear about later on. I'll also have the calendar of events, the comments of the week, and the What I'm Tasting This Week department.
Whiskey Cast. Proudly brought to you by Redbreast. The definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. Join the stillhouse at singlepotstill.com and receive an exclusive whiskey tasting journal.
Whiskey Cast is supported by Glenfiddich, the world's most awarded single malt. To join other single malt appreciators for exclusive news, vintage releases, and preferred events, visit glenfiddich.com.
Glenfiddich, skillfully crafted. Please enjoy responsibly.
Let's start off with the week's news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie. Since we're in the middle of the holidays, it's a light week news-wise, but we got word this week that White & Mackay met its deadline to get Shackleton's whiskey back to New Zealand. This is the latest chapter in the Shackleton saga, which began way back in 1907 when Sir Ernest Shackleton took several crates of McKinley's Old Rare Highland whiskey on his mission to reach the South Pole. Shackleton had to abandon his expedition and left three crates of whiskey behind at his team's hut. It was discovered a century later, frozen in the ice. One crate was recovered and taken to the Canterbury Museum in Christchurch, New Zealand. Scientists there were able to thaw out the whiskey and allowed White & Mackay to take three bottles back to Scotland for analysis. Master blender Richard Patterson was able to recreate the McKinley's recipe, which is now in its second bottling to raise funds for the Antarctic Heritage Trust. The agreement called for White & Mackay to return the original bottles to the trust by the end of 2012, and they arrived in Christchurch earlier this month. Now, when the bottles were sent to Scotland, Richard Patterson had to fly them back personally on board White & Mackay owner V.J. Malia's private jet. The trust refused to allow the bottles to travel in the baggage hold of a commercial jet. That attitude changed for the return. The whiskey was sent in a specially secured container via DHL from Glasgow to Christchurch, and it'll be returned to the ice in Antarctica and reburied at Shackleton's hut. Now to more modern pursuits. Earlier this year, we met Laura Davies, the new distiller at Penderyn Distillery in Wales. Laura is about to become a lot busier. Penderyn is investing in two additional stills to triple its production capacity. That's right, two stills to triple capacity. Unlike most distilleries, Penderyn uses a single specially designed still for the entire process. It's a combination of a pot still and a column still, and the final spirit comes off at 92% ABV. By the way, I've tried the Penderyn new make. Even at 92%, it's still very drinkable. And finally, the City of London is one of the financial world's global centers, with the financial firms in the Square Mile City District handling a significant chunk of the world's wealth. But a new report indicates that the Scotch whiskey industry actually generates more productivity than the city's financial wizards. The Scotch Whiskey Association commissioned the study from Four Consulting as part of this year's centennial celebration for the SWA. It estimates the total impact of Scotch whiskey on Scotland's economy at £4.2 billion a year, with £2.9 billion in direct impact and £1.3 billion from associated suppliers. Four Consulting estimates each whiskey industry worker accounts for £275,000 a year. That's 57% more than workers in the City of London. Of course, whiskey workers are more valuable to us. It's a lot easier to enjoy talking about whiskey than it is to talk about collateralized debt obligations. I think even our listeners who work in finance would agree with that. And that's the week's news.
The news is brought to you by Glenmorangie. Visit us on the web at glenmorangie.com or download our iPad app at the iTunes App Store. Glenmorangie, unnecessarily well made.
If you didn't get the whiskey gift you wanted for Christmas, well, you can always buy your own present in the WhiskeyCast photo gallery. Shameless plug aside, I've had some free time over the holidays to go back through my archives and add some new prints to the gallery, including one of a stormy day at Ardbeg. There's also a second gallery now that features some of my non-whiskey prints. Of course, you'll find the link at the WhiskeyCast website, and if you're in the Philadelphia area, my Art of Whiskey exhibit is still on display at Calumet Photographics Gallery on Columbus Avenue through early January. Let's check the comments of the week now, brought to you this time around by Highland Park. Scott Mansfield of Australia shared a link on Facebook to the BBC's recent documentary on whiskey. Addicted to Pleasure features actor Brian Cox and examines both the history of whiskey in Scotland as well as its social impact today. I've posted Scott's link on the WhiskeyCast Facebook page, and as Scott puts it, it's well worth an hour of your time. Last time around, I mentioned the problems that can result from mixing painkillers with alcohol, often leading to a fatal overdose. There were several poignant comments, both on the WhiskeyCast Facebook page and my own personal Facebook page. One of my daughter's friends told us that his father died in just that way. And longtime listener Christopher Winters in Indiana, who also happens to be a doctor, noted that his hospital is holding a symposium to educate both doctors and local residents about the danger of combining painkillers and alcohol. As he puts it, it is all too common, and we all, including physicians like myself, need to be aware of this. Finally, we've had some nasty winter weather in the U.S. over the last few days. Bill Rogers writes from Minnesota, "The power went out during last night's blizzard here in Wisconsin. Since my ice cubes were going to die a slow death in the unpowered freezer, I decided to give them a burial at sea in a tub of Bomora 15 Mariner." Well, that beats the burial at sea most of us are familiar with, usually involving the family goldfish. By the way, I also had some Bomora 15 this week. It goes really well with my wife's flourless dark chocolate cake that's a holiday tradition around here. Experiments with other Islay whiskeys and what little is left of the cake are ongoing. And if you have a story you'd like to share with whiskey lovers around the world, I'd love to hear it. You can always post a note on the WhiskeyCast Facebook page or just email me. My address is comments@whiskeycast.com. And the comments of the week are brought to you this time around by Highland Park.
My name is Daryl Haldane, Global Brand Advocate for Highland Park. Go onto our website at highlandpark.co.uk and upload your photo at Inner Circle to have your face on the walls of the Highland Park Distillery.
Whiskey Cast, brought to you by Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. In conversation with Tim Brennan, retired engineering supervisor, Redbreast single pot still Irish whiskey.
I've worked with Irish distillers for 40 years. I was born in Middleton and went to school in Middleton and then joined a company in 1971. Traditions in the old distillery were if you were involved in a very dirty job, you then got a half glass of Redbreast. They were the perks in the old distillery. We had one guy there who was particularly fond of his glass of Redbreast, and in order to go to the manager of the warehouse, he would get a really dirty bag of dust and he'd shake it over himself so that he looked so dirty, and he would head off over to the manager and say, "Mr. Daly, here I am. I've had a terrible dirty job for the morning. Look at the cut of me. Any chance of getting a half one?" And he'd duly get his half one, come back, change his clothes, and he was fine again.
Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. Those in the know, no Redbreast.
Time now for the calendar of events, brought to you, as always, by Laphroaig. If you're in New York City, there's a Hurricane Sandy benefit coming up on January 6th at the Kingsway Jewish Center in Brooklyn. The Whiskey Weekend Amsterdam is January 11th through the 13th in the Netherlands. The Distilled Spirits Epicenter in Louisville has a week-long distilling class that gets underway on January 14th. I'll be at the Victoria Whiskey Festival again this year in British Columbia from January 17th through the 20th, including the announcement of this year's Canadian Whiskey Awards. On that note, tickets are available now for the inaugural Winnipeg Whiskey Festival, February 22nd. The Universal Whiskey Experience returns to Las Vegas on March 2nd and 3rd, and the Whiskey Classic will be in Morristown, New Jersey on March 7th. Finally, the inaugural Bourbon Classic will be in Louisville on March 22nd and 23rd. Those are just some of the whiskey events coming up as we get into 2013. If you have something you'd like to add to the list, you can always email me with the details. The calendar of events is brought to you by Laphroaig. Take a virtual distillery tour at laphroaig.com, and while you're there, become a friend of Laphroaig and claim your own square foot of Islay.
WhiskeyCast is supported by Glenfiddich, the world's most awarded single malt. In 1886, William Grant set out to fulfill a lifelong ambition, to make the best dram in the valley. Today, a rarity in Scotland, Glenfiddich still remains independently owned by the fifth generation of the same pioneering family. This unique legacy of skill, passion and pride forges a long-term commitment to creating truly great single malt, without compromise. Glenfiddich, the world's most awarded single malt. To learn more about our award-winning range and join other single malt appreciators for exclusive news, vintage releases and preferred events, visit glenfiddich.com.
Glenfiddich, skillfully crafted. Please enjoy responsibly.
WhiskeyCast In-Depth is brought to you this week by Woodford Reserve Bourbon. A lot of people want to get into the whiskey business, one way or another. This week I received an email from a listener who's close to retirement from his current job and is thinking about a second career in craft distilling. I also heard from Craig McGill in Scotland, who passed along a link for one of the several whiskey-related projects on Kickstarter. Now, if you're not familiar with Kickstarter, it's a website where entrepreneurs can promote their products, most usually technology-related, and they offer you a chance to help fund the early development of a product. In exchange, you'll usually get the product when it's released, or small investors will get credit on the website, something like that. There are different incentive levels for different pledge levels. The key is that each project has a fundraising goal, and the pledges aren't collected until the goal is reached. Craig sent me a link for Karen Castillo's Kickstarter project. She's based in San Francisco and wants to bottle her own blended Scotch whiskey. Her goal was to raise $39,000 to help pay for production, bottling, labeling, and shipping costs for the first batch. She reached her goal, and then some, with nearly $46,000 in pledges in 40 days. Unfortunately, Karen wasn't available for an interview to discuss her project, which faced one of the few restrictions on Kickstarter campaigns. You can't reward pledges with alcohol, but you can reward them with whiskey-infused chocolates. That was the product Jim Gable came up with. He's on the board of Belgrove Plantation in Virginia.
Well, Belgrove is a historic plantation. It's in the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia. It was originally built in 1797, and today it's a member of the National Historic Trust for Historic Preservation. And it's got a deep history by itself. It was built by a fellow named Major Height, and Height's wife was the sister of James Madison. So James and Dolly Madison spent their honeymoon at Belgrove. So it's got a deep history, and one of the Civil War battles of Northern Virginia, the Battle of Cedar Run Creek, was also headquartered at Belgrove. So it's got a rich, deep history, and it's part of the community out here. And interestingly, one of the former board members is a fellow named Rick Wasman, who you know is the owner of one of Virginia's distilleries. And Rick has, for a long time, been looking at the idea of building a new whiskey that was based on the kinds of grains that they would have used back in early American days at Belgrove, because, of course, all the big plantations had their own distilleries, and Belgrove had a distillery right there on the property. And they did research to the kinds of crops that they would have used and the kind of business that they had, and found some interesting writings about that back then. So Rick has been working on that project. And I joined the board last year, and they will always remember the day I came in for an interview, because they were sitting in the office with Rick tasting whiskey. And they always thought that was a very funny way to introduce a new board member to Belgrove. So,
and we should explain that Rick runs Copper Fox Distillery and produces Wasserman's whiskeys, and I want to make sure we get that in and give him all due credit here.
Absolutely, because he deserves so much credit for the whole idea and direction of this thing. But where I came in was on the chocolate front, and it's sort of a backwards compliment, because I don't drink whiskey. And it's not for any strong reason. I've just never taken a liking to it. I'm just one of those people. And so I thought it was a great idea, but I looked at him and I immediately said, we should make whiskey chocolates. And the reason that struck me immediately is I grew up in central Kentucky. I grew up surrounded by bourbon distilleries. And in Kentucky, for a century, we've had bourbon chocolates. In Frankfort, Kentucky, there's a wonderful company called Rebecca Ruth Candies.
And oh, yeah.
They've been around over 100 years. So I grew up with Rebecca Ruth Candies. And throughout my life, I would use Rebecca Ruth Candies for gifts and sometimes Christmas. And just no matter where I lived around the country, I would order some and use them. So for this completely unusual reason, the moment they said we're going to make a Belgrove whiskey, I said we should make whiskey chocolates. So that's how we got started. We didn't know anything about doing it, of course, so we had to research it and talk to a lot of different chocolate companies and talk to Rick and had to figure out everything about boxing and just, you know, all the logistics. So we put that together. We found a chocolate maker who's also local, so it's really a complete Virginia project now. And it's a company in Harrisonburg called Chocolate Occasions. They've been terrific. And with that group, Rick found recommended a designer in Reston, Vicki Valentine, who has been amazing because I think our box design came out terrific. I mean, it really is a great sort of evokes the early American tradition of Belgrove. It's very attractive. It's just very nicely done. And we'll also match the labels coming out on the new Belgrove whiskey as well. So all that kind of came together. And meanwhile, my background is more in the high-tech world. So I've have friends who've done projects on Kickstarter. And I was a little bit familiar with it and really wanted to try to use Kickstarter to basically give us a bigger boost at intro, because you get a lot of startup costs with just design and production and printing and everything else. And so with Kickstarter, and Belgrove is just a small organization, so with this we could really find outside support for the new chocolates, and we launched it, and it just closed yesterday, and we passed our goal, and so we had a very successful run.
And what are you going to use the money for?
This money goes for producing the early batches of chocolate. It also goes towards the upfront costs, like designing it, printing the boxes, getting some of our materials and molds together. So it's really, you could sort of say it's a startup cost.
As we all know, a lot of folks who work on Kickstarter offer incentives to their angel investors as part of taking part in the early stages of this project. How did you come up with your incentives, and what did you wind up offering to your investors?
Yeah, they always have different reward levels for different levels of backing. And the thing about Kickstarter is it's sort of between investing and shopping, because it's really not shopping, because the project you back may not succeed, and in the end may not actually be able to finish the product. Ours was low risk that way, but others can be high risk. And it's really not investing, because you don't own a share in the resulting company, if that's what's going on. So somewhere in between, but it's interesting and fun, and people it's definitely hit a nerve because it's been such a success. And so it's up to the person making the project to put together interesting reward levels for the people. And for us, we did different reward levels, and we tried to get some of our candies into every reward level. So there's one entry reward if you just want to kind of give us a small boost. But the most popular one was for one box of the chocolates for $29, including the mailing anywhere in the U.S. And then we had another one. We had a box of chocolates plus a little Belgrove stemless wine glass that we have used at wine festivals at Belgrove. So it just adds a little variety to it. And then we had a few permutations beyond that. But those were the two most popular reward levels. And that's exactly what I hope people would want to do, is get some chocolates, try it out. Hopefully they like them when they try them, and reorder later.
What happens next? Now that your campaign is closed, you're getting the funding, because you don't get the actual money until the campaign closes and you actually get funded completely, right?
Correct, yes.
So what happens now?
So at this point, we go to work on doing our fulfillment. So our backers will get an email pretty soon asking for their mailing address, and we have scheduled ours to fulfill in January. So we'll put in the order for making the chocolates. We'll make sure we get everything ready to mail them out and get organized to do all that. And we'll send them out in January, and that way people will have them in time for Valentine's if they want or anything else. And then we're going to use some of the funds to also improve our website so that in the future people can log on to our website and buy whiskey chocolates if they'd like to.
Was it hard coming up with your incentives? Because one of the rules about Kickstarter is that you couldn't include the whiskey. You couldn't say, yeah, for $100, we'll throw in a bottle of one of the Copper Fox whiskeys or the Belle Grove whiskey. So that was sort of a limitation for you in coming up with the incentives, right?
It was. And, you know, shipping whiskey's got all kinds of issues, so we never thought we could do that. But, again, what was sort of handy for us is because of that, we could just focus on the chocolates and make a nice story and make it clear what we were proposing and what the rewards would focus around. So that worked out okay, actually, for us in this instance, because the chocolates are very distinct by themselves. So we did tell a little bit of the story of the whiskey in our Kickstarter project. We have a great picture of Rick at his distillery with some of the giant vats that I just love. So we were able to tell a little bit of both sides of the story, but it was focused on the chocolates.
Would you do it again, and what did you learn?
I would do it again. It was a great experience. It is the thing I learned is to do a nice job is more work than it looks like when you first sit down with it. There's work to get the Amazon payment set up. There's work to get nice graphics, because the average, I would say that the average level of graphics on Kickstarter is pretty high. People do a pretty professional-looking, nice job. We had a little stop-motion video of the chocolates. It was sort of for fun, but give you a feeling for the place and for the chocolates and, you know, what you're supporting, basically. And those videos, some of them are so outstanding. So it was a little daunting to put up something that would kind of fit Kickstarter, that wouldn't look really second-rate compared to the other projects on Kickstarter. But Kickstarter's got thousands of projects, and they do vary a lot. But you do feel a challenge. We edited that 16,000 different times, and we really ended up doing a lot more work getting it done. And so I think the big takeaway is start 2 months earlier than you think you need to. That's the one thing I wish I had done differently, is that I wish we'd started even sooner, because it did take a lot longer than anticipated. And this is after I'd gotten a lot of detailed feedback and advice from companies that had done big Kickstarter projects. So I have friends in the Bay Area who did a project called InstaCube, which is a picture frame for Instagram photos, and it was a huge success. They raised a lot of money. And so I got a lot of very good advice from them about how to do a good Kickstarter project, and how to make your short statement very clear so people see at a glance what your project's about, and a lot of little hints and tips for just making a nice project. I probably had better coaching than other projects did, but even then, it took longer than expected. So I'd say start 2 months earlier than you think.
And you'd do this again for another project like this?
Oh, I would, yes. It's very fun. It gives you some exposure. I guess going back to hints for other people concerning Kickstarter is make sure you have some other funding source, some other marketing source, some other idea of people who might give you money outside of Kickstarter. Because in the end, half our money from Kickstarter were people who already knew Belle Grove, and half of it came from people who had never heard of us before. Now, if it were really big, I expect that ratio would be quite different. But for a modestly sized one like ours, it was very important that Belle Grove sent out emails to all its members and that our friends, many of them, contributed early on. So early on, you get a burst of backers. So it doesn't look like a project that's going nowhere. So that was extremely important and very, very helpful. And I think that if you did not have kind of a built-in fan base that's going to get your project started, then your chance of success is a lot lower.
Having that built-in audience really does help make Kickstarter projects successful. Los Angeles whiskey blogger Rob Gard just completed a successful campaign to generate the capital to publish his new book about living on Isla and working at Brooklatty.
The initial impetus to do the Kickstarter route came from the fact that when I was reaching out to publishing companies and agents who were on the verge of signing me, one of the biggest and most enthusiastic responses they had to me as an author, other than the actual work, was the whiskey audience that I had and the connection I had with the industry. And as the attempt to publish the book continued over a few months, I kind of thought, well, why don't I just publish it myself, since they're going to be using me to use my contacts to try to sell the book? Why not retain that control and reach my audience directly rather than through an intermediary?
So how did it work?
It's an interesting process. I have a good friend who has successfully funded several books through Kickstarter and some other campaigns that I've supported along the way. But the primary thing that you do is you have to design a campaign that explains what you're looking to do. In my case, it was a book. In other cases, it could be a movie or a product. And reach out to audiences and tell them directly why you need their funding to make this project move forward, and also what they will get out of that participation in the project. In my case, I created several reward levels that allowed people to kind of tap into some of the whiskey community without actually giving away alcohol, which is one of the challenges of the whiskey book or any other kind of alcohol-related Kickstarter campaign, is you can't actually give alcohol as a reward. So it's a double challenge, try to raise money and raise support when you can't give people what they're actually supporting.
And how was it received? I know you reached your goal fairly quickly, but you actually went over your goal, didn't you?
Correct. I started off with an initial somewhat low goal. For me, it was just under $3,000. The book that I wrote, Distilling Rob, which talks about my time working at the Brooklatty Whiskey Distillery and living on Isla, and uses that as an analogy for how boys mature into men, kind of comparing the whiskey-making process to the maturation process. The book itself I had completed a couple of years ago after that time, and it was ready to go. And the thing that I needed to do was to raise funds to do a final edit with a couple of different editors, do the book design, and then physically publish the book. And so I set out a relatively low goal of $2,900 that would give me the very basics. And within a day, I reached that goal. And as word of the campaign built, I ended up closing in on about $7,000 raised, with something like over, I think, about 140 supporters, which was pretty spectacular for such a quick campaign. It was only a 30-day campaign.
So this allowed you to actually go out and do even more and make the book even better and more detailed, right?
Exactly. I'm actually in the process of looking at my editor's remarks right now. And it gave me the flexibility to, yes, basically make a better product. And I think one of the things that helped with funding my book so successfully is both my background as an author, or not as an author, but certainly as a writer, as a journalist, as a screenwriter, but also the fact that I have a finished product, essentially. And so I was able to show excerpts of the book, and people knew what they were getting into. They weren't just blindly supporting somebody who says, I have an idea for a book. They knew that they would get a deliverable when this was done.
And the book will be out this coming spring, right?
Correct. At the rate things are going, it should be out in March. That was my initial goal, and I'm pretty sure I'll be able to keep with that. Like I said, it's gotten a great response from my editor, and I'll see, you know, knock on wood, anything tripping up that March publishing date.
So what did you learn from this?
Well, there's several things I learned. One is it actually took me just as long to organize the Kickstarter campaign as it did to write the first draft of the book. It was about a 4 to 5 month process for me to get the Kickstarter campaign ready. I had to create a video. I had to work with people on different rewards. I had to actually get the campaign site itself in order. And that was one of the things that I learned pretty much right away, that in order to be successful, you need to look at this as a business plan, not necessarily as a charity thing or, I'm going to win the lottery by putting this thing out there and lots of people are going to give me money. You need to look at it as a business and plan accordingly. You can't just put it together, on a whim. And I think the planning process and the ability to connect with people along the way of the planning process enabled me to meet my funding goal within that first 24 hours and then proceed from there to nearly triple the goal.
So would you do this again for your next book?
Absolutely. And that's one of the things that I find is a lot of the more successful publishing campaigns on Kickstarter are already established authors. It's a way for them to gain control over their book and over their work. And also, it gives you that direct connection with an audience you might not otherwise have if you're at the mercy of a publishing company.
Full disclosure, I was one of those who contributed $25 to Rob's campaign, and I'm looking forward to reading his book. One other Kickstarter campaign of note, Joe Ledbetter of Chattanooga Whiskey successfully raised more than $11,000 earlier this year, with the goal to buy a bottling line and equipment for the distillery he hopes to build in Chattanooga, Tennessee. His whiskeys are currently produced at MGPI in Indiana. Since distilling whiskey is still illegal in Chattanooga, Joe's working to change the law. If he's successful, his donors will have their names branded into the wall of his distillery. That's an interesting idea. And that's this week's WhiskeyCast In Depth, brought to you by Woodford Reserve. Visit woodfordreserve.com for well-crafted holiday cocktail ideas. Craft carefully, drink responsibly. Bourbon whiskey, 45.2% alcohol by volume, Woodford Reserve Distillery, Versailles, Kentucky. The What I'm Tasting This Week department is brought to you this time around by Bal Blair. Let's start off with the Evan Williams Single Barrel 2003 Vintage Bourbon from Heaven Hill. This one will be appearing in U.S. stores after New Year's Day. It's bottled at 43.3% ABV. The nose is full of molasses, toasted oak, cocoa, honey, and a mild touch of vanilla. The taste is spicy with cinnamon and black pepper notes, along with honey, vanilla, and a hint of cocoa underneath. The finish is long and spicy with a lingering cinnamon touch. I'm scoring the Evan Williams Single Barrel 2003 Vintage a 92. Next up, the first release in the Johnny Walker Explorers Club series for travel retail markets, the Spice Road will be followed in 2013 by the Gold Root and the Royal Root editions. It's bottled at 43% ABV. And as one might expect from the name, the nose is a bit spicy, with ginger, nutmeg, and cinnamon notes, along with hints of honey and coconut. The taste is smooth and spicy with a good cinnamon touch that doesn't overpower the ginger, caramel candy, and vanilla notes, and just a hint of coconut. The finish has light, soft spices that linger well. I'm scoring the Johnny Walker Explorers Club Spice Road an 88. And finally, Glenmorangie's next private edition release will be Iolanta, as we heard from Dr. Bill Lumsden back in episode 396. This one is matured in virgin American oak casks from Missouri and bottled at 46% ABV. The nose has notes of toffee, toasted oak, vanilla, and caramel, along with hints of roasted almonds and honey. The taste is spicy and bourbon-esque with a great cinnamon bite. Aromatic notes of linseed oil, vanilla, and a hint of roasted almond come out as the spice fades. And the finish has lingering cinnamon and linseed oil notes, along with caramel, toffee, and honey notes that just last and last. I'm scoring the Glenmorangie Iolanta a 92. You'll find my tasting notes for these and more than 700 other whiskeys in the free WhiskeyCast apps for iPhone, iPad, and Android, and at the WhiskeyCast website. That's also where you'll find links for the stories in this week's episode, the calendar of events, the WhiskeyCast photo gallery and print shop, and, of course, a complete archive of past episodes. The address is WhiskeyCast.com. And my email address for questions and suggestions is comments@WhiskeyCast.com.
WhiskeyCast is supported by Glenfiddich, the world's most awarded single malt. To join other single malt appreciators for exclusive news, vintage releases, and preferred events, visit glenfiddich.com.
Glenfiddich, skillfully crafted. Please enjoy responsibly.
WhiskeyCast. Proudly brought to you by Redbreast. The definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. Join the stillhouse at singlepotstill.com and receive an exclusive whiskey tasting journal.
As we end 2012 and begin 2013, here's hoping that your new year is a happy, healthy, and prosperous one, full of joy and gratitude. Thanks for another great year. WhiskeyCast is a production of Cask Strength Media, copyright 2012, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.